You too, then.
Oh, yeah.
Sweet, man.
How are things? How are you?
I'm good. Yeah. Nice to meet you.
You too.
Yeah, life is good. We're leaving in, we're going to NAMM next week, and then we're leaving the following week for Europe for 7 weeks.
Oh, yeah, shit.
So that should be exciting. Yeah, to say the least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to get a bit of your credits in.
Sure.
Best known for, according to some YouTube comments, the hardest working member of the DTP.
Yeah, not according to others. Yeah.
But you've got actually an insanely pretty extensive career. You recently toured with Steve Vai.
Mm-hmm.
Multi-instrumentalist. You played drums for the band Regal with Mike and Dave Young,
mm-hmm.
and Dominic Fricot, as well as composing and drumming for the project Alchemist EP.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you took on the role producer, programmer, and assistant producer for that as well? Or assistant engineer?
The Project record?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was me. Like, that was my thing. So I did all of that.
Yeah.
Basically, I had some guys came in and played some other instruments, all the other instruments, I suppose. And then I had a guy come in and mix it, and someone else mastered it. But,
okay.
Everything else was kind of my project, which was a lot of fun at the time.
Yeah.
Also stressful, but it was good. Yeah. I was really happy with that, actually.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And you're playing keyboards, visual and light director for the Devin Townsend Project, and today he gets to hang out with this loser. So,
hey man, I'm stoked.
thanks for doing this. I always feel it's really awkward to ask for interviews, like, you need to even be on my podcast, but it's...
I'm down to hang out for a minute.
Cool.
Just down the street, have some coffee, shoot the shit.
Oh, man. Great. Well, this, I don't know if you'll remember this, but this was 2011 at the
Crazy.
Children of Bodom headlining tour. That's who it was.
Okay.
At Commodore.
Yeah, yeah, at the Commodore?
Yeah.
Wow. That's awesome, man. Takes me back.
Yeah. You were, you came to Vancouver fresh out of university, right?
Mm-hmm.
From Ottawa.
Yeah.
And had a jazz degree. Mm-hmm. And hated metal?
No, I didn't hate metal.
Yeah.
I just wasn't really exposed to it. There was obviously like the shredder guitarists in my music program.
Sure.
In school, but I grew up listening to like Raffi and orchestral music, like soundtracks, and then I had a brief stint in the pop music world until my dad kind of put Led Zeppelin and like Roy Orbison and stuff in front of me. And so then I was into the rock world, and I was in my prime right in the sort of mid to late 90s, which was kind of, as was happening on the West Coast here as well, like there was that can rock thing was really doing really well. So I was really into that alt rock kind of thing. But,
tragically hip kind of thing? Or?
Matthew Goodband,
oh, yeah, yeah.
Big Wreck, and then like Radiohead kind of. I was late to a lot of stuff. I'm usually late to a lot of stuff. in life as in music. And then I was studying jazz at the program that I was in. And I just never listened to heavy music. I don't know.
Okay.
I just never did. And then completely off my radar. Yeah. And then I'm out here and I get introduced to Devin, and I remember before I went to meet him, like the name was familiar, but I didn't really know him or know of him. And so I pull up, like, it wasn't Spotify back then, but it was YouTube or something, and I pulled up something off of Alien.
Oh, yeah.
As a, like, who's this Devin guy? And it's just like, whoa, this is something, yeah. So that was my introduction to heavy music, but, I've learned that it's, for one thing, it's the people that you're with, especially when you're working in it, more than the music itself, but then also the music itself is... I'm always a fan of like good music. It doesn't really matter
what it is.
Yeah.
Good music is good music. Sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So country, pop, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. I was watching. I kind of rewatched the Transcendence documentary, and especially your episode. And you describe yourself as being a lot of people saying you're their spirit animal.
Yeah. Yeah, that was... I mean, Zim did a really great job with those documentaries, but I remember he really wanted to have fun with that one, I guess, and make man, Simon and Garfunkel, eh? Make a artistic statement with that one. I don't know. He wanted to just do something different with it. So he ended up, because everyone had their stories. Ryan had the motivational speaker thing. Dave had the Krav Maga thing. Beef had the sushi thing. I think they went to his sushi place. And then Devin is Devin. And I didn't really have like a story other than this like nebulous what is life kind of French poet thing or something, existentialism. So he turned it into that whole whatever he did there. It was hilarious. But I think it might have got lost in translation how much of it was tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, people thought you're weirder than you are or something.
Or not as weird as I am. Yeah, it was interesting. I met a couple people on the American run that we just did as a kind of a out of that, who were like, giving me a hug, and like someone wrote me this really long kind of, or no, it was something they had written in the past, but it was a bunch of thoughts on like on life. And it actually reminded me when I graduated, I started minoring in philosophy in university, which didn't help. One of the classes I took was deconstruction in music, and it's this applying this philosopher Jacques Derrida's deconstructivist philosophy to music, and it's a really interesting way to destroy any kind of grip you might have on like what is anything for that matter, but in music as well, like what's the point of silence versus like noise, or loud versus quiet, or you could call it tonal music versus just atonal gibberish, right? And in a sense, you could actually apply a lot of that to Dev's work, I think, as well. It would actually be a great thesis. But anyways, this person came and brought me like this ideas of hers about like life and how this all applied to that in a sense. It was really interesting. So it was positive because it started some good conversations, I think, as well.
Yeah.
But it was a little unrealistic, I think. Only a little bit. Like, that wasn't my real apartment. I don't sleep with a microwave beside my head.
No, I didn't think so.
Nor do I really fancy taquitos.
Get them into your body right quick.
But
in that one, you describe yourself primarily as a musician, but evolving to be an experienced producer. And I'm kind of wondering, where do you think this... your love of like technology and art and photography and all these things kind of come from, and how they play into your life now?
Well, they are my life now, I guess. I am trying to be aware that not necessarily that they shouldn't be or that they don't have to be, but just that there is that other side, like making sure to take a walk in nature every once in a while, making sure to put my phone down. I'm trying to have my phone out of mind while I'm sleeping, so I don't wake up in the middle of the night and start like looking at Instagram or something. Trying to not be just completely buckled into technology all the time, which I think is important. But right now, I mean, it's my entire career. It's also really facilitates music in a sense as well, right? Everything's online. I was thinking yesterday about how we are all connected to this platform, Facebook, where they have a billion users or something like that, right? So you can be anywhere in the world, and as long as you have a device, you are effectively connected to a billion other people just like that. And there's a lot of, that breaks apart into a whole bunch of other ideas, I guess. There's a lot of significance to that, but it all came from, I don't know, being an only child. My dad worked in sort of computers as a career, so he always... we had computers before anyone else had computers. Like, I don't know how old you are, but...
24.
You're 24. So you're just... probably just after that era of... like, when I was... how old would I have been? When I was, like, 10 or... no, 13 or something like that. Let's say grade 7 or something like that, whatever that is. 13. I think I might have been the first one. We got, like, a 486... computer, which is like 486 megahertz, not even, no, I think it's 486 megahertz or something like that, right? Processor.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the guy across the street, and so everyone was at my house.
Oh, yeah,
And then
the
guy across the street got like the 666 or something like that, so everyone was at his house. And then the guy down the block got the 933 megahertz, so everyone was at his house. And it was this, like, growth of technology and what it could do and the games, you know, Half-Life and Unreal and stuff when that was like no one had ever seen anything like that before.
Right.
And that's, it really is, you're just so fascinated by it, right? It's creating these other worlds and creating these other realities. And I think for me, I'm a bit of an escapist in that sense where I wish for other places, maybe other times, I don't know, other circumstances sometimes.
Yeah.
I'm grateful for the reality that I'm in and the things that I have created and even just the experiences, maybe the not so great experiences that I've had, but I'm a bit of an escapist, so technology really helps with that. And but that comes back to the duality of like trying to spend time in nature. I was talking about this with a buddy just the other day, like as experienced creators, he's looking at virtual reality and augmented reality and all that stuff. And from my perspective as well, I'm really interested in creating VR, like with Regal, we were talking about creating VR music videos and VR experiences. Like, what would it be to release your album on VR, basically?
Wow.
So you just throw the goggles on and each song has a different world or, you know, a different narrative or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
All of that kind of stuff. But then also there is a bit of a what's the point to it. And that's an interesting, not struggle, but an interesting kind of narrative to follow through life as well. Like, we spend all of this time with our technology and some of it's really beneficial, like the Facebook connected to a billion people thing, but then it's also very separating. It can be very ostracizing. And you know, the not so distant reality where everyone's wearing sunglasses, like VR glasses,
mm-hmm.
and now you can't interact with people unless you nudge them or something, right? Like, we already have lost this public random socialness because everyone's staring at their phones. You don't talk to the person next to you anymore.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's creepy to be like approached by someone, apparently, as far as my experience has shown.
Yeah.
Once VR is a thing or augmented reality is a thing, it's going to become almost rude to go up to someone in the street and say like, hey, can you tell me where this is?
Or, yeah,
just to connect. And that's I would argue, not great, especially with what's happening. You don't have to look much further than America for a great example of this division and ostracization and the breakdown of community. And if people, to get super ridiculous, if people just loved each other more, if we had a stronger community, if people trusted each other and depended on each other more,
yeah,
the situation in places like the U.S. Would be a lot different, I think, and in Canada as well. I was just reading a friend posting this article about how in the U.K. there's this sort of global in the UK sense of fatalism in terms of like we're going to be sort of poor forever and there's nothing we can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if people knew that they could rely on each other and knew that they could work together to create a bigger and better reality for themselves, then they would, but they don't. Anyways, technology, it's a blessing and a curse.
Well, like, it can be really, like, tiring, too, this feeling like you have to keep up with kind of all that stuff.
Oh, man. Yeah, yeah.
And I imagine, too, it can be, like you said, but, like, Facebook being connected to so many people, it's like, you're also connected to people you don't, like, in our case, pretty much, you connected to people you don't know.
Oh, yeah.
And then you get asked to do interviews like this. And then you get to talk about
it. The worst. Yeah. I mean, it's... I'm not in a position where I get bothered that much, we could say.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas other people obviously are.
Sure.
And then they have to go to lengths to deal with that. I think at least the grass is greener, maybe. Right now, I would love to have the problem of having to hire someone to manage my social media accounts or whatever, right? But... fortunately or unfortunately, I don't have that problem. I keep in touch actually with a few people through like my artist page, and I think that's another positive, is that it is a powerful tool to be able to do that. And there's the growing your own business side of it, where the more people around the world you can keep that contact with, the better it is for business.
Yeah.
But from a more of a community perspective as well, it's like, it's important to have that connection, I think, because even though we may be distant from each other at the coffee shop, I can post a message about something and anyone in the world, a billion people potentially could see it, right? Mm. Although I have much fewer than a billion likes on my
Facebook. by a couple, like
one or two, yeah, a billion. Yeah,
I think from listening to again the Transcendence talk and kind of seeing what I have seen of you, knowing what I do know, and just talking now, you seem like you have a very kind of busy brain. And
yes, I suppose I do.
And like you mentioned, you've been trying to make a conscious effort to go out and be disconnected from kind of those things. How is it working for you?
How is what working
for me? Being disconnected, being...
Oh, it's great. The best thing you can do, I think there are probably few of us who wouldn't benefit from meditating every day.
Yeah.
Right? I know some people that I look up to and are very inspired by are doing that every day, right? Like meditating in the morning for 10 minutes or whatever it is, and meditating at night for 10 minutes or whatever it is. It's a really good way to bookend your day with, for lack of a better term, positivity. Yeah. Even you can call it forced positivity, or just trying to recalibrate, realign your brain. It's really easy to, I think all of us, it's really easy to get derailed by a very simple occurrence. Like today I was eating a sandwich and some of it fell off the sandwich, like onto the table. And I'm the kind of person, unfortunately, where simple things like that, like spilled milk, when I can keep myself outside of it, I think I'm pretty resilient in like pretty heavy situations. I can not lose my shit and keep my cool and like deal with it, because I've had to deal with some situations like that professionally or otherwise.
Sure.
But when I can't get over myself, that spilled milk thing drives me berserk. Like,
yeah.
You know, I don't really act out, but I just, it like makes me boil on the inside.
Yeah.
And sometimes we have days where we wake up and everything's fine and then we stub our toe or something. Or we wake up and the first thing we do is look at our device and we see, oh, I don't have as many Facebook likes as I thought I would. Or this person's bashing me or something. Or, oh, some shitty news story, right? Look, we got a new president. Or, or you know, death and suffering. And then now you start your day in this headspace. And also the idea that kind of like, if you think about, well, they always say make your bed in the morning. This is, if you look up like habits of highly effective people kind of thing, one of them is make your bed in the morning. Before you leave the house, make your bed. And in a sense, meditation is a similar, I would say, analogous in that respect, where when you get up in the morning, before you leave to live your day, like make your bed in your mind. Tell yourself some good things about yourself. It'll really give you the confidence and extra energy maybe that you need in the day. It could keep you from making rash decisions, you know, calming yourself, not being in a stressful position. Also, it means that you have to get up early enough that you're not just rushing into your day as well, right?
Right.
Stuff like, you know, also this is all hearsay and not necessarily stuff that I'm achieving every single day, but even just, you know, putting your feet on the ground and taking 10 seconds before you get out of bed to like, today's gonna be a good day. I'm doing the best I can. I like to tell myself that there's this duality of, in a sense, you're not in control of anything. You're not in control of what the world throws at you. Anything could happen at any moment in time. Great success or, you know, extreme suffering could come your way in an instant. You're not in control. But at the same rate, you are in 100% control of your actions, of your reactions, of what you set out to do every day and what you do.
Mm-hmm.
So in one sense, you're not in control. And in the other sense, you're in complete control. And it's important to let go to that being out of control. Let life throw you what it's going to throw you, because you're not in control of that. It's important to let go to that. But then it's also important to recognize the great control that we do have, the energy, the creative force that every single person is, and that they can be. And again, that comes back to starting your day, reminding yourself of that. Like, I could go out today and change the world forever. In fact, you will every single day if you want to.
Yeah.
If you want to just be a spectator and like eat Cheetos and watch movies, which I do sometimes, then you won't really change the world, right? But if you want to get up and go out and create something, whatever it is, that's really powerful. So disconnecting in the morning and in the evening is a really good way to, I think, maximize the potential for doing something that in your mind is like positive for that day.
Yeah. You mentioned you minored in philosophy. How much, well, what you were pretty much describing was sort of like Stoicism, the old philosophy of Stoicism. It was basically you can't control what happens, but you can control your reaction to it, I thought.
Okay.
Just very what little I know about philosophy. And
apparently I know very little about Stoicism.
What did you mean when you said, again, a lot of this is from the Transcendence, because I watched a few things just to, okay.
Yeah. Who is this weirdo? Yeah.
What did you mean when you were kind of frustrated with Dadaist, Brian Eno, cultural appropriation, reggae? I remember you were talking about that.
I mentioned that in the documentary?
Yeah.
And what was the first thing you said before Brian Eno?
Dadaist.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
What was that? What was the context of that though?
You said you were just frustrated. You had been recently frustrated by it. So,
oh, right.
Anti-propaganda noise bleeding.
Well, so there was this exhibition at the Vancouver Art Gallery.
Okay.
Called Mashup. It was one of the bigger events that they've bigger exhibitions that they've done, and it was brilliant. It was taking us through mashup culture, which. This is not really dub, but what would this be? Is this reggae, I guess? So it took us from, okay, now we're in a world where everyone takes everything and reappropriates it. Like, this is a picture on the wall here, we're looking at a picture of something that says Puff, and I feel like I've seen that before, but that's, I guess that could be an original drawing, but it kind of looks like someone took a picture of something, right?
Yeah.
And there's more, we're up there, that picture of that sign, relax.
Yes.
They didn't make the sign, but now someone else's art, in a sense, is in this photo as art.
Yeah.
So this is like a reappropriation of someone else's work. And now we're calling this an original work of art, but the focus of this original work of art is someone else's work of art. This goes all the way back. So in this exhibition, they're showing the origination of this, which was sort of upper class girls, like, if you have like an aristocratic father or whatever and you're this young girl, they would keep journals, and we're talking like, was it 14th century? Maybe it was 18th century. I'm really good with history. But they would keep these journals, and they would take paintings of like ducks on a pond, and they would cut out pictures or maybe illustrations of their friends and tape their heads onto the ducks or something like that.
Okay.
And this was the first time that someone had taken one thing, like sort of an artistic statement or a photo or a illustration, a capturing of something, and like put it on something else and called it something new, in a sense, even though it's an unprofessional situation, right? It's just girls being girls.
Sure.
And so you get that sort of scrapbook. It was the scrapbook idea. And then it moved, you know, go way down the line and you get to dub music, which was taking the instrumental reggae tracks, if I'm not mistaken, and then dubbing them out, like having way more bass in there and throwing on that sort of triplet delay thing and getting them all wet, and like that kind of idea was, I can't remember the name of the guy who did it, but it was this like one guy in Jamaica who did this, and then that led to I guess went over to the UK and became like dub, like garage music.
Oh yeah.
And then dub, and then you get dubstep, and then which wasn't Skrillex, but then the American, you know, Los Angeles flavor gets a hold of that and you know, Hollywoodizes it, and then you get like Skrillex dubstep, and you get that sort of like sampling of vocalists where they're like, they take a vocal and they throw it up an octave and they put it into a sampler and you get that like glitched out sample-y version of someone's performance.
Right.
This is all, it begs the question, you know, where does it end and where does it begin anymore? And I don't remember the context of what I said that when I went off on that rant or whatever, but I was probably just suggesting that I find it hard to make a statement in a world where there are everyone seems to be making a statement, I'm making quotation statement,
yeah,
these days, and it's so easy in a sense to make a statement and get it out there, you know, $20 on TuneCore, whatever, and your statement is all over iTunes, all over the world. So the world is saturated with people's statements. Now where's the value in that? It used to be that no one could get their statement out there unless some rich guy, aka a record label, paid for them to do that. And if they decided that you were going to be the person to get to make a statement, then the entire world hears it, and they only hear you and a handful of other people. And then you get situations like the Beatles and the Doors and Zeppelin and that whole era of basically vinyl artists. And then it went into CD artists, where the world only hears what a hand... picked few decide that they should hear,
yeah,
and as a result of that there's this huge value placed on that art, we'll call it, but then, you know, all the floodgates open and music is free, so A, there's like literally no monetary value to it anymore, to recorded music, and B, everybody seems to do it or think they can do it, so where do you find your value? And also in the people who are doing it poorly or really well and successfully and unsuccessfully are sampling, and so you get entire songs based on a song from like two generations ago that people, I think a large majority of people don't even realize that this was something completely different at one point in time.
Right.
And this artist has done something really cool with it, but it's important that at some point, I think it's important at some point that we recognize where that came from.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, I think there is always, there's often a significance to the music that they chose, in a sense, to, and then how it's being used now. Even if the artist doesn't realize it themselves, you can sort of draw some kind of significance there. What I really like is when, I just heard it on the latest Fantagram album, I can't remember the track, and then it's also on, there's a group called, what are they called? The album's called Looping State of Mind.
Okay.
And I cannot remember, I think it was Looping State of Mind. Great, great artist who takes samples, like really, really short samples of like the 60s era, would it be 60s doo-wop kind of music.
Okay.
And then does like really samples that are so short that when you repeat it, it's at like 128 beats per minute, but the sample is of some slow like doo-wop ballad kind of thing.
Okay.
And yeah, I can see you looking it up and I'm trying to remember the artist.
The Field.
The Field.
Yeah.
So The Field's like whole thing for a couple of albums there, I think, was sampling like this Dolly Parton or whatever this country thing is, they would take a sample of it that was so brief and in such a weird place that it was like completely non-musical, but then they would loop it and build upon that loop and you would get these kind of like almost trancey dance numbers out of it.
Wow.
But out of these clips that you have no idea where it came from because it's so
so obscure.
Obscure kind of thing and impossible to reference. The song itself might not be obscure, but this clip is like, yeah, it's like the tail end of some chord or something. Anyways, Fantagram did it on their latest album, and The Field did it on some song, I think on Looping State of Mind, where at the end of the song, they let that sample unravel and you hear what the context is, like where did that come from?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really great nod to like, oh, by the way, this was actually this.
Yeah.
And you can check that out if you want. it's like 50 years old and is completely, the energy and the context and everything is completely different than what we've done with it here, but at least you can hear it and Shazam it or something, I don't know.
Yeah.
To find out what that is and maybe look into that or get into that. But I think that's really interesting, and at the same time further complicates this whole like making music thing, I guess. Because I'm really quick to be like, oh, I'm listening to like Deadmau5, now I want to make some house music.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm listening to John Hawkins, I want to make some more obscure electronic music. Or I'm listening to Panic or one of those other like super nothing is happening ethereal kind of things. Now I just want to make fridge humming kind of
yeah,
hummer or something. Or I'm listening to Bonobo and now I want to go back to making like the Alchemist EP, making like a jazz quartet meets electronic meets orchestra thing. I think ultimately that's still what I really like to do. But or I'm listening to Meshuggah and now I want to make EDM djent album. Or I listened to what Jake Bowen, Periphery Jake, released a record that's awesome, kind of not so much like Tycho, it's almost like William Orbit kind of stuff, but just kind of this chill electronic stuff, and it's like, oh, okay, I want to do that now. And there's so much great stuff happening, I find it really, and given everything else I just talked, ranted about, I find it hard to have a voice,
mm-hmm.
and to know what I want that voice to be. I know that I want it to be conscious, in a sense, like to say something that people can say, oh, not only did I feel really good emotionally from that music, but this person's actually talking about something of interest other than like brushing their teeth with a bottle of Jack Daniels or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But again, I stop there and I have a really hard time with lyrics as well, because it's hard to find what to talk about, in a sense.
Sure.
But then you get artists who do it really well, and it's like, oh, well, of course, I'm going to sing about a girl, or I'm going to sing about love or life or losing a job or whatever, because the way that they write it is, you know, really good.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's my problem. I just need to be better at writing.
I think, to go back a little bit repurposing art, I guess, I don't know if maybe into is the right word, but I've been listening to a bit more like old school DJing, like where they still had like turntables and things,
right.
instead of just, you know, tight shiny shirt and your hand in the air or whatever.
Yeah.
And I watched the 1995 Grandmaster Rock Raiders winning set.
Okay.
And watching it was crazy. Like there's a lot of it I don't know. I didn't watch the Get Down on Netflix, so
okay.
I don't even have a rudimentary.
Yeah.
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 But just watching him do that and kind of
sampling, like, right?
Yeah, and making something new out of something old, and then just watching how he did it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he'd have the two turntables and his back to them, and he'd be turning.
Right.
And
yeah. Yeah.
What do you think is the value? Is there much? What am I trying to say? What do you think is the value in kind of repurposing art, things like that?
Well, that's a good question. I think that it's necessary in a sense, because you can only in a matter of moving forwards. That's part of it, I guess. You're gonna have people who are always looking beyond that to like what's the next, you know, the, just the very edge of that spearhead kind of thing, like what is next. But then you've got people who aren't necessarily behind them, but we could say beside them, just taking everything that's going on and repurposing it, or revising it is another way to look at it, reimagining it, recontextualizing it. And at the end of the day, like I said, I like good music, right? But in a sense, it's almost like good experiences. And Looping State of Mind and the new Fantagram album and all their other stuff, I'm sure, is the same concept in a lot of those places where... Or Moby did it too, I think. You're sampling stuff and making something whether it's for a new generation or whether you're still in that same generational era, whether people recognize what you're doing or whether they don't recognize what you're doing, if you're making something that people find value in, then it's great. As long as you recognize how you did it. But of course these people know how they did it.
Yeah.
It's just kind of, I think maybe the greater question is like, is it important to recognize where it came from? You know, does it matter that an entire generation of people saw Kanye team up with Paul McCartney and they were like, who's this Paul McCartney guy? Wow, he's sure gonna have a good career now that Kanye picked him out.
Yeah.
You know, is it important that was a thing? Like, should people know who Paul McCartney is, or should Kanye, maybe it was great that he did that because maybe he opened the door to a whole another generation of people discovering
the Beatles or
yeah,
whatever.
Wings or whatever. But you know, so it doesn't matter whether that knowledge gets disseminated, or does it just matter that someone has a good time? And I think maybe it doesn't matter, because at the same rate you hear stories about people who, you know, this album or this song saved my life, right? Like, I was going to kill myself and then I found this song, or I had a death in the family and this song got me through that. It doesn't matter if that song is sampled or if that song is like genuine instruments being played into an analog console live off the floor or
yeah.
whatever, you know. It all that matters is that this oral phenomena is captured and it meant a great deal to somebody. You could make something out of origami and it might be the most precious thing that someone ever has for their entire life, right? So does the fact that it's a piece of paper folded up matter versus like a diamond or something like that?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think that Steve said something really cool on the last tour. He does these meet and greet things, and often I would be in the room programming lights while he's like right there doing them. And one thing I heard him say was that there are as many truths in the world as there are people. Everyone has their own version of the truth, and in that sense everyone has their own experience of life, and we can't ever be in anyone else's shoes. We can try, we can pretend, but we can't ever experience an entire lifetime up till now in someone else's, you know, the way that things will taste differently for you, the way that music will be different for you, the experiences and this, that, and the other thing. Like, it's every person has an infinitely different perspective than every other person. So that you kind of start to lose value in a lot of things because one person's rags, another person's riches, and one person's trash is another person's treasure. So it doesn't, I guess long story short, it doesn't matter how it came to be. If it means the world to someone else, then I think it's actually pretty important that it be there, without getting into a conversation about does anything matter.
Yeah.
Is nothing important?
Because then you get down this whole rabbit hole and
yeah,
who
I mean,
knows
I think
where
we
you
could,
get from there.
Yeah, we could come to some conclusions, I think. Ultimately, it would just be, again, this truth thing. If it's important to one person, then it's important. Because mm-hmm. if it's their whole world, it doesn't matter if it's completely off everyone else's radar. It means the world to that person. And for them, that is that person's universe. Like, the universe... I was watching some space show the other day, and I could be completely destroying this, what they were saying, but I'm pretty sure they were saying, wherever you are at the center of your universe, possibly literally.
Yeah.
Because when we're in a telescope satelliting the Earth, and we look out in every direction, everywhere we look, we see that waves. Damn, what is it? Radio waves. The background waves.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. The background gravitational waves, I think.
Yeah, from the Big Bang.
Yeah.
Blah blah blah. And when you look at a map of it, it's like here's this. It looks like a globe, right? Here's this circle around us, and that's as far as we can see because from our point of view, that's the Big Bang happening. But if you could jump immediately to where those waves are, they were saying that, well, now you would be in another part of space, and if you were to look back towards the Earth, you would see those background radio waves. So where's the edge of the universe, and where's the center of the universe? Potentially, wherever you are looking outwards, that is the center of your universe. So perhaps there is no center, per se. And if that is the case, then the center is wherever the observer is, and there's 7 billion observers on this planet. So in a perhaps too esoteric way, each person is the center of their own universe, literally.
Yeah.
Or esoterically. And in that case, value is actually... I don't know if it gets too wishy-washy at that point, but value becomes literally what you make of it. So if you think that this music is shit, then it's shit. And if you think that it's the greatest thing ever, then it's the greatest thing ever in your universe. But you have to recognize that your universe is only, and the truths in your universe are only as significant as the 7 billion other truths and universes out there. For all of us, gravity is true. So, you know, it's pretty significant. But, you know, for some of us, Miley Cyrus is the greatest thing ever, and for some of us, Elvis is the greatest thing ever. But that's not as strongly held a truth across all the people.
Not really quantifiable.
Yeah, and then so it starts to lose, almost, you could say, it loses significance in a sense, right? But then you get down to, you start to become like, looking at things like, I think it was Plato who said, in a utopia, there would be no art, because it has no value. That's a ridiculous paraphrasing. But yeah. In the pursuit of... Well, no, I would have to go back and read that. And take that back. I'm pretty sure Plato said that.
Yeah.
No art in utopia. Yeah.
Anyway. Well, is that kind of your emotional connection to music, is that it has to be significant, like you said, maybe socially responsible, I guess, would be a decent way of putting it.
It'll change every day, because my first response would be my connection to music is that in this somewhat nebulous existence, music, sound waves are something that I can create, I can control, and I can share with others. And so that's like a poet, right? Or like a movie maker, I can create something and share it with other people, and some of these people enjoy it, and it enriches their existence. And there isn't a whole lot more we can say with certainty than that we exist. And then I guess phenomenologically, like, we have feelings, and if I can exist and create something that makes someone else's existence feel better, or, you know, help them explore their existence, or however you want to put it, to me that's a really powerful thing, maybe. Or I give that significance in my universe. Yeah. There's a lot of significance to making something that you can share with others and that they can maybe grow with, or something to that effect. I find that to be a thing. But then also, so we might be expecting you to say, like, vapid music is shit because they make it just for money, and then what does it mean? Is there, you know, any value to it? And some people are really, really hate on that pop factory music. But at the same rate, there are probably a lot of girls, for example, who got through some really tough times because they had Justin Bieber's music. Mm-hmm. And it could have been music written by the Beatles, or, you know, written by one person instead of a cast of people trying to make money, in a sense. Although you would also argue that all those people are still there to make music. They just like pop music. And some of us demonize pop music, so we think that they must be demons. But actually, they just, in their universe, pop music's great.
Yeah.
But if that McDonald's hamburger of music gets someone through immense depression, or helps them become someone who, you know, helps them stick around long enough to cure cancer or something like that, then you could argue that there's a lot of value in that McDonald's hamburger. maybe indirectly, but so it's hard to. That's when you get into that, you know, that transcendence video where I just am talking about nothing at this, all at once. But like, it's hard to place value on anything when everyone places their own value. So yeah. I'm just telling you where I think there's value.
Yeah,
and even that changes every day. So
I was it's like a never-ending. Like I do it too. I guess I sometimes demonize pop music right here and go, "Oh, this is fucking garbage." But it's kind of hard to remember sometimes. Like, it could be important to somebody.
So there was like a time when Metallica was pop music, in a sense. Maybe not. Maybe in, I don't know, who was the pop star in, like, what is that, the 80s? I guess there was still, like, George Michael and stuff, like, pop music.
Yeah.
But even then, the guy was a musical genius, you know? Queen was pop music, I'd say, for a second there, right? And that guy's a musical genius and wrote incredible music, I guess. Yeah. Maybe the argument is now it's taking more and more people to write simpler and simpler music, and that's not, I guess one argument is that it's not getting people to think as much as it used to.
Yeah.
As it used to, again, I'm saying with quotes. But you know, it is what it is. It's hard to say. I think in my universe, I think people should listen to more classical music. People should listen to more music without lyrics. I think people should listen to music with lyrics that are trying to get them to think outside the box. It's like schools that are trying to get kids to think critically, and schools that are just trying to push kids through. I think there might be kind of music that is trying to get you to think critically, and music that's just, you know, let's party and have a good time. And I guess there is value to that music as well. It's just the danger is that you end up living your whole life eating Big Macs rather than having that Big Mac on a Friday night.
Yeah.
You eat that Big Mac for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and now what is your reality becoming if every day you're listening to brushing your teeth with Jack and Coke? I don't know. There's probably examples of, I don't know, is there examples of like human rights lawyers who listen to Miley Cyrus on the way to work? I'm not sure. That would put things into context though, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then as it comes back to music again, I don't know if it's a weird outlook to have, but I like the idea of making music for people who are making the world a better place, if that makes sense. And I don't think you can, I'm not saying that you can pinpoint those people as to what kind of music they listen to, but to me, just the idea that, again, a human rights lawyer, I guess, is a decent example. They were like, hey, I have this really hard case that made a really big difference in the world, and your music got me through. I'd be like, right on, because I want the world to be a better place, and this seems to be a good relationship.
Yeah.
Instead of, I remember going to a metal festival. It was, I think, the first or maybe the second time I was there with Devin. And heavy metal, some people are really kind and sweet, and some people are caught up in that macho thing. Mm-hmm. And there was this group of guys and girls, and this one guy had cornered a seagull and was grabbing it, picking it up, and wringing its neck, like breaking its neck, just killing this fucking bird, and like putting it back down, and it was like fucked up, and he went and grabbed it again and like twisted it, like broke its neck basically, because he was a macho asshole. And so it's hard for me to not have that in my mind when I think of certain aspects of like quote-unquote heavy music.
Yeah.
I don't think you'd find a lot of people at a Miley Cyrus concert or a Justin Bieber concert cornering an animal and killing it, right? But then again, I suppose this guy is maybe a psychopath and those people are found everywhere, so yeah. I don't know where I was going with that. Good. Vapid pop music maybe is as every bit less damaging than some music some people would call genuine music. And the people who listen to it are evil people,
yeah.
Right? So, again, Jesus. How do you provide value to anybody? Yeah, I know, this guy's an asshole, right? And it's hard, that's something that's always stuck in my head, but
yeah.
It's, I don't say that the band that he was listening to are terrible people, or
no.
That music is terrible. It's just,
what that vibe attracts sometimes.
Yeah, in a sense, and some people would say that that's why they got out of heavy music, or a certain brand of heavy music, is because it was attracting a lot of negative energy, right? And you don't, as a creator, you don't want to be making, you don't want to be wasting your time, or even whatever the opposite of wasting your time is, like, not having value, but like actually having, like putting negative value out into the world in a sense, creating the end times because of your creative output.
Yeah.
I think most of us want, I guess some people do want that, but a lot of us, I personally want to have people be like, hey, I just made the world a better place and I was listening to your music while I did it,
yeah,
rather than I strangled this seagull out or whatever.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, heavy music has that idea attached to it more than like jazz ballads.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also a study that says that people who listen to heavy music are like less angry because they get it out of their system, whereas people who don't like thrash every once in a while get all this pent up rage and don't know what to do with it, and then they do thrash in inappropriate situations.
Yeah.
And I'm also then thinking of, there's a couple shows you may have seen, one where like someone will come and like brutally murder a family or something, and they like put on this really beautiful classical music in the background.
Oh yeah.
And I'm sure that's more of like an artistic decision to create that contrast in the scene.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder how many people like have actually done that.
Yeah.
And in that case, the person who wrote that music never, I would imagine, meant it to be used for that.
No,
right?
I can't imagine
so
it would.
That's another interesting thing about this art and recontextualization, is what gets done with the things once we put them out there.
Yeah.
Once you create a photo or a costume or music or a movie, what does it get used for? Like, I don't know if it was Metallica or whoever found out that their music was being used in torture like chambers or whatever. Yeah.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I think someone may have actually somehow released a list of songs that were played. Might
oh,
have
yeah,
been
yeah,
like
yeah.
Lamb of God or something,
mm-hmm,
like that was like found out.
Yeah.
And obviously was pretty bummed about it. Because it's, I mean, in that sense, it's not, well, it is kind of the energy of the music, right? It's like they're trying to hit you with sleep deprivation and like strobe lights and then music. They're not going to play a calming, you know,
ambient thing.
Yeah,
but, you know, yeah,
they're going to play like really intense music, but that's that context. Again, if you look at the other side of it, where people who can crank up their stereo and thrash on the way to their office job are less likely to go postal at their job because they like had their morning workout and
yeah,
now they're not like pent up with rage. It's the people who apparently listen to classical music and never get that out of their system that one day show up to work and like,
I'm know, worried about my aunt now.
Yeah. Hey man, I like classical music. I don't think I'm about to go postal on anyone, but yeah.
I was listening last night to Alchemist.
Oh, cool.
I was really fucking good. I don't know why it took me that long to listen to it, but
no reason to listen to it, I guess. Apparently, my marketing campaign ended in 2010, so it's a little off the radar. But yeah, thanks, man.
Yeah, and your drumming was really good on that.
Thanks. Heavily edited, but thank you.
Yeah, it's.
The way we go. Yeah.
How did you put, well, you said you put that, it was kind of your thing. I'm wondering how you put it together.
I've been writing music forever, and I've been playing in bands forever, and I when I moved to Vancouver in 2008, I was at this jazz bar and I heard Bonobo for the first time. It was a song, Transmission 94. It might have been Recurring, actually. The song Recurring by Bonobo. And I was like, that's exactly what I want to do with my life. It's like, basically, you've got like drums, upright bass, keys, ambient kind of noisy Stratocaster kind of reverb and delay shit. And then throw some horns in there, throw like a small string quartet in there, and then some DJ twirly electronic noise guy, either sampling the band itself or just making like delay noises and stuff over top of it.
Yeah.
And I thought it was brilliant. The Cinematic Orchestra has another band as well. It's just incredible music. And so I started writing more in that style for about a year, year and a half. When I was in 2010, I had a close family member pass away suddenly and tragically, and it really gave me this sense of like life is short, and you know, do something now at all costs kind of thing, like the importance of putting something out there for people to hear.
Mm-hmm.
In my case. And so I took like 5 demos and I charted them all out, and I got the artists together. You know, I got an upright bass player and a guitar player and a keyboard player, people that I actually really was really inspired by their playing. So it was really cool to get them to actually come out, because I was sitting in a room with people where I was like, it doesn't matter what you do, it's going to be awesome. And yeah, it doesn't matter, you know, here are the charts, so play these chords. And we would talk about, you know, this will be like a jangly guitar part, and then this maybe we can turn up the distortion a little bit, and we do a bunch of passes. But we also jammed it out, like drums, bass, guitar, and keys, and we jammed these, you know, we'd do the verse a bunch of times, the chorus a bunch of times, and then it's a bunch of extra passes with some stuff. I played some piano in some parts, and then brought in a horn player, this guy Evan Arnson, who's like play everything. So he played clarinet, he played sax, he played maybe that's all he played. a couple different saxes though. Like he had like a tenor and an alto or something. And then this gal came in and played French horn, which is great. And string players came in, and then I spent like 3 days straight just editing it, like drums and all of the parts, and sort of arranging it, because we had recorded it in a very doing a bunch of passes in different sort of genres, building intensity kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then I went back and sort of listened to all the takes and you know, pick and choose to build like a song out of it or an arrangement out of it. And yeah, did all the editing, and then a friend came out and mixed it for like 3 days straight, at which point I was just like exhausted. I basically fell asleep for 24 hours, I remember, and when I woke up, he was like, I was like, wow, that sounds incredible, right? And then we just did some tweaking, and it was done in about a week. Like we had got people together, gone into the studio, tracked it all, edited it all, mixed it all, and it was done.
Jesus.
And it was great. And I like that about making records, like where you're like, I mean, we do it generally, traditionally, that's how bands do it, I think, traditionally.
Mm-hmm.
You go into the studio and you track drums and you track this and you track that and you edit it and you mix it and you master it and you're done. And it's a kind of a statement of that moment in time as a representation of the last year of life and writing and stuff. Whereas now it's like I don't feel that urgency, and I don't have the money or the time or like a label being like, give me another product.
Yeah.
To urge me to write stuff and go in the studio and do it, which I think is a shame, because I would love to be ashamed just for me. I would love to be putting out more music and having more of these catalogs of this is where I was. Like if you look at a guy like Devin, who's got 20 or more records, he can, when he's, you know, wherever on in the future, he can go back and be list put on a record, and it'll bring back like so vividly the people who were in his life at that time, where he was living, what he was up to, how he was doing, how everyone else was doing, how the world was doing, where he recorded it, who was around, blah blah blah. And you can do that with every single record, but when you aren't doing that, then all of a sudden it's you gotta, I don't know, reference other things. I'll be referencing like the tours that I did or other people's records that I played on and stuff like that. But yeah, it's also songs start to build up, and then you've got all of this music, and it starts to lose significance in a sense, because it's not as urgent and current anymore. I've got demos that I've got the next record, 10 songs done like 2 years ago or something, and I don't even want to go through the motion of doing it anymore, because I'm already somewhere else. I'm like 2 years further down the line.
You're not as connected to that as
If someone gave me $10,000, I'd go and do it, but I don't. Yeah, exactly. oh, hey, sir, I heard you need 10 grand. So, but yeah, I don't foresee that really happening. I'd love to say that I'll do something this year, but it's also always a matter of what do you want it to be? And for me, if I'm going to do another thing like the record that I did, and I would love to do a follow-up to that, I know what it's going to cost and what it's going to take, and I'm not prepared to do that, I guess, to make it what it needs to be. I've got friends who are saying, like, oh, I don't bother putting real strings on it. Put, like, a Nord version of the strings on it, or an Ableton version, or VST strings. And in my mind, it's like, no, but that's not what it is. It's yeah. not a VST album. It's supposed to be real and organic, and you're supposed to have those mistakes, and you're supposed to have that performance in there. So in lieu of not having the cash to do that, do I want to make like a laptop album in a sense, right? Or something where we can track track drums in like a little apartment, and it's going to sound like drums in a little apartment. So what kind of music would you want to write if you knew that your drums were going to sound like really dry and small and dead in a sense, because you can do a ton of like post production on that to make it sound big, but
yeah,
I don't know. Yeah, or do you go and track it with like Easy Drummer or something, going tracking into Easy Drummer, so you have drums that sound amazing. It sounds like Thomas Hawk or something like that, but you played it on an electronic kit.
Mm-hmm.
Does that warrant it? And then this comes back to the contextualization and the repurposing of things. Like, does it matter how you made it if people just hear it and they're like, oh, that's sick. Like, it's not the greatest example, but Animals as Leaders' first record was programmed drums. I don't know if Periphery did programmed drums on a record, but we know that Animals as Leaders, one of the records, was programmed drums. And it's, you know, it's great performance, in a sense, great programming. But people weren't listening to that record saying, oh, man, those drums are sick. Although yeah. they were listening to it saying, oh, wow, that sounds great. It's great programming and stuff. People were listening to it saying, wow, that guitar playing is sick. And if Tosin had programmed the guitar playing, I don't think it would have been the same reaction.
Yeah.
People aren't saying, oh, wow, that's amazing music, although it is. They're saying, I can't believe this fucking guy is playing that shit, right? Like, that's insane guitar playing. It's very musical and it's great, and I love those records, but... if he had just written it and programmed it, it would be different. So when you're making a record, how much of it do you want to have people be like, you know, this is a production versus this is a real band playing stuff?
Yeah.
These are things I think about.
We've talked kind of a lot about drums, and another kind of part of your world is keyboards and all mm-hmm. these things. And I have no business making music. I do a little bit anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Not good, but...
Yeah. Hey, man, if you like it, as long as you're happy with it, yeah.
And when you're in San Fran, you went with Dave to the Dave Smith.
Yeah, that was awesome.
How was that?
Cool. That was great. Those guys are awesome, yeah. Yeah, it's a really cool little facility. They do it all right there, mm-hmm. and it's, you know, it's a team of like a dozen or a dozen and a half people. Just, I can only imagine like living the dream. They go into this beautiful open space office and fuck with synths all day long, and then they've got this display room, yeah, where they can mess around there. But they're literally kind of like leading the world in awesome sounding analog synth stuff.
Okay.
And they're all really great people. I mean, how chill would you be if you lived in San Francisco and messed with synths all day long? Yeah.
Yeah,
it was cool. It was great.
What kind of equipment do you, like, equipment software do you use?
So I have a Dave Smith Mofo X4, it's called. It's based off their Mofo module, but it's like a keyboard.
Yeah.
It's my main, like, analog cred instrument. And then I've got this Korg Triton Tactile. It's a controller, but it also spits out the sort of original Triton sounds, which Dev uses all over everything.
Okay.
So I felt like it was in the market. When I was in the market for a controller, I found this thing and realized, like, well, that covers one of my bases right there. I don't need to figure out a VST equivalent of this. It's just, there's the sound right there. And it takes... processing off of my laptop because it's like creating the sound right there. I'm using Keith McMillan makes a really cool like MIDI foot controller just for changing patches and stuff. I use that. I'm using a M-Audio Code 25, just another controller. I don't have a lot of analog, as it were, stuff because, you know, at one moment I need to be doing like brass shots, then another moment I need to be doing weird synth things, and then I need a piano sound, and then I need a Glockenspiel sound, and then I need some, you know, sequencing something, and or just, yeah, anything, right? Basically at any moment I, in my mind, need to be prepared to deliver any sound. So obviously a laptop is a part of that setup. I'm using Ableton, using a ton of VSTs. I just started using the Serum VSTs, which is pretty cool. Really powerful, way more powerful than I know how to use it right now, but it does some cool sounds. I mean, it's basically just a lot of in-the-box Ableton stuff. My Ableton Live set is like just gargantuan now because I've got, I don't know how many songs we've played in the last 5 years, but I've got, you know, a scene or a bunch of scenes for each song doing all of these changes. It's a bit of a, I can't believe that it still like works in a sense to go back and play an old song and it like still works with the setup, but it does. And then we're using like Camsys for the lighting, we're using VDMX for the visuals, and it's all, you know, as a master computer, also using Ableton, sending MIDI triggers over Ethernet, like networks basically, to over MIDI to Devin's guitar rig doing changes there, over network to my other Ableton session to change my patches, triggering all the lighting in Camsys and triggering all the video. So it's a networking nightmare, but it works. It allows us to do it with, you know, one person rather than three people. So that's cool.
I love shit with just too many buttons and knobs. I would love to tour with the band and just press all their shit.
I mean, it's fun. It's just getting the time of day to do it and not be stressed about it, I guess, right?
Yeah.
I think this next tour is gonna be a good one because we're pretty prepared. We've done this before, so hopefully nothing is going to be a surprise. It should just be a nice walk in the park, knock on wood.
I noticed on the Alchemist, you had some of the reviews on there, and Chart Attack compared it to Final Fantasy music, almost. It says,
right. I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
That's cool, man.
Are you much of a gamer, or do you...
Not really. I mean, no. Nobuo Uematsu, I believe, did the Final Fantasy stuff, and that guy's like a genius. That guy like single-handedly revolutionized video game music, so that's cool.
Yeah.
I'm happy to be compared to that. I don't think it was really, I mean, maybe I haven't really listened to the Final Fantasy soundtrack, to be honest, but I'm not really a gamer because it's that thing, like, I'm in this virtual world. I don't know how I belong here. Where do I belong in reality versus virtual reality? And also, I was never really very good. Like, the majority of my youth, of my experience with video games was playing with like my best friend, who was just incredibly good at video games, like you know, god level everything, beating everything on the highest difficulty in like no time at all. He just, his knowledge is, I don't even know how the guy's not like an exec at some video game company by now, but and so, you know, we would play that way where I play until I die and then he plays until he dies, which is like 3 hours, and then I play for 5 minutes and then he plays for 3 hours. So I was just like, okay, this is not really that fun anymore, I think. Yeah. Was part of the thing, but I just gravitated towards other things. I do really like the idea of making music for video games.
Mm-hmm.
I do really like the idea of making virtual worlds for music, but I don't spend a whole lot of time. I did start messing around with like Unity and coding for video games and getting into that a little bit, but I never really had a project to finish, so I never finished. A lot of projects I start and don't finish, apparently.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think video games are great, but I just am not a big gamer. I don't know where people get the time of day, to be honest, to like play video games.
Yeah, I don't have a lot as much as I used to.
Yeah, I guess there's that. Yeah, but I see the guys like the periphery guys too will post like playing whatever game for like days and days, and I'm like, dude, you have interviews, you got clinics, you got videos, you're making records, and you're touring. Like, where do they have the time to be? And personal life, like, where do they have time to be?
Yeah,
playing video games, but apparently they do sometimes. So, I kind of liked the Call of Duty style games, but I'm so bad at them.
Oh yeah.
I really liked. So I would play like Unreal Tournament, which is a similar kind of Call of Duty before Call of Duty, I think. Yeah. But then I would put on like God mode and fly mode and just be able to like fly around the level like shooting at people from wherever and no one could kill me and stuff. That's
I'm terrible at them too, so I just end up just spinning around and
exactly, spinning in circles.
I usually try to apply GTA logic to Call of Duty and it usually doesn't go over well.
Yeah,
no cars to steal
and like beat someone to death.
Yeah.
Not so much. And then you get like the 7-year-olds who are like sniping you every time you spawn somewhere. Like, oh,
and then fucking your mother. Yeah. It's the worst.
Right. That too. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that I have a lot of respect for people that can make music, and I love talking, even though it's really not what I do. I have side project, but
it's cool, man. Keep making music.
I do like talking about it, and I'm always really appreciative of people such as yourself who will come on and indulge me and talk about it.
Yeah,
and
sure.
I don't know if we've already been an hour and a bit.
Look at us go.
We can just keep it
going.
A
couple peaks there. That's where that lady sneezed. You can see it.
Yeah, that one there. Yeah. And I think that one is the kid.
Oh, yeah. Perfect.
But I don't want to take up too much of your day. I don't want to monopolize
it. Oh, yeah. That's cool, man.
So
it's good to chat.
Thank you for coming. Thanks for
sure.
Being on
yeah.
the show.
No problem, man.
You can find all of Mike's media at mikestjohn.dunked.com or Mike St. John Music on Facebook. Deep TP's tour starts the Europe one, January 28th to March 18th, and then there's a US, Australian, and New Zealand tour May 6th to the 26th, and you've got the Ocean Machine big show coming up September 22nd.
Yeah, I got some songs to learn.
What are you promoting at NAMM? Or anything, or are you just
going
to...
Myself, yeah. I like going. I think it's a cool way to start the year, in a sense. It gets me... gets me kind of fired up, because you see it's overwhelming, but it's also talking about like having an overworking brain.
Yeah.
That kind of overstimulation can be somewhat meditative, in a sense. At the end of the day, when your brain is just like done, and it's done because it's been exposed to musicians and artists and technologists and all the new gear and stuff, I think it's pretty inspiring. So I'm not promoting anything. Nobody cares who I am, except for me and you. Yeah.
That's, hey, two people is all you need.
Yeah, right? Two. It's just a fun way to start the day. Like, our front of house, Lisa's going to be there, and
cool.
A good buddy of mine, Adrian, from Sights and Sounds, and he worked on the Transcendence record, actually, as well. He's coming down. Devin, obviously, will be there. Ryan's going to be there. And then just people, you kind of run into people. Last year I ran into Javier from Animals, and just, you know, hanging out with everyone goes to this hotel lobby and you just run into people and hang out and be like, hey, that was fun, see you next year, basically, right? But it's cool, it's a good energy. I like the energy that you get off it.
That's cool, man.
Yeah.
Thank you for being here. Thanks for letting me pester you for an hour
and
more.
Man. Thanks for inviting me out. Yeah, it's a treat.
And thank you guys for listening.
Cheers.